Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Cue the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for joining us for our first anniversary episode. We started Cue the Case on July 22nd, 2023, which interestingly, I didn't realize when I picked it, but the 27th anniversary of today's case is on July 24th. So the timing worked out well since that's just a few days from when this episode comes out. I'm happy with the growth of the podcast and how we've improved since the beginning and how many cases we've been able to cover. And we're just grateful for all of you who continue to listen and encourage us to keep going. It's wild to think some of you have been listening since very early on and have stuck with us since then.
I definitely think we've improved as time has gone on and we've developed a better flow to the episodes and it is very encouraging to see all the positive feedback we get via email or Instagram or, you know, reviews on Spotify and Apple. It's been fun so far and I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah, me too. I think we've gotten more comfortable with recording. If you've never recorded a podcast before, in our experience, the first episode was so uncomfortable. Like the first trial was just so uncomfortable. I don't even know how to describe it, but we've gotten so much more used to it at this point. We enjoy doing it. We enjoy bringing attention to cases that need attention. Today's case is definitely more well-known. So we are straying from the typical type of case we cover since we focus on lesser-known cases. But I've always been interested in this case and I wanted to research it for myself. I learned a lot of new information and I think it's okay for us to cover a case that's a little more well-known from time to time because they still deserve coverage since they're unsolved. Normally, we put the sources in our episode notes, but there were far more sources for this case than will fit in the description, but you are more than welcome to reach out if you have any questions about our sources. We want to remind you that we are taking next week off, but we will be sharing a collaborative episode we did with a couple of other podcasts. So definitely check that out. And like we said last time, we should be back to our normal schedule in August. All right, let's get into it. Amy Robechtel was 24 years old at the time of her disappearance in 1997. Amy was born to parents Joanne and Duane in California, but she primarily grew up in Jackson, Wyoming, where her dad was the first town manager. After elementary school, Amy's family, including her two older sisters and older brother, moved to the small town of Douglas, Wyoming. She had a tight bond with her siblings, evidenced by the fact that when Amy's brother got married, she and her sisters stood by his side as his groomswomen. Those who knew Amy best described her as bright, quiet, goal-oriented, and one friend said she was the sweetest person she'd ever met. Amy also loved nature and being outside, so Wyoming was really the perfect place for her to live. When Amy was in high school, she joined her school's track team. The way her family describes this is that Amy was not a naturally gifted runner. She wasn't very fast naturally, but through immense effort, she gradually became quite skilled. After graduating high school in the early 90s, Amy enrolled in the University of Wyoming in Laramie, which took her to another part of the state. It's in southeastern Wyoming. Amy majored in exercise physiology, and so much of Amy's life revolved around being active, so this was a perfect choice for her. Amy joined the University of Wyoming's cross-country team as a walk-on, and she set the school record for the 3,000-meter run. And she didn't walk on the team and just immediately set this record. It did take her a few years to improve and develop her skills as a runner, and she even contemplated quitting at one point. While Amy was in college, she met a fellow exercise physiology student named Steve in 1991. Steve and Amy had a lot in common. Namely, they both had a love for being active. Steve was not a runner like Amy, but he was a skilled free climber, which is a type of climbing where you don't have aids to help you. The pair began a relationship that lasted beyond their college years. Shortly after they graduated in 1994, they got married and moved to Lander, Wyoming, a town Amy had visited many times before when she was growing up in Wyoming. Lander is a hub for outdoor activities, hiking, rock climbing, fishing, you name it. So you can see the draw for people like Amy and Steve to move there. It was of special interest to Steve because it has some of the most challenging climbing spots in the country. And it's a somewhat small community with a population of about 7,000 when they moved there. Amy and Steve rented out a home from a man named Todd Skinner, a widely known and respected free climber, and his wife, and the couples became fast friends. Amy found part-time employment at a sporting goods store called Wild Iris Mountain Sports, where Steve was employed too. She also worked at a fitness center leading a youth weightlifting class, so she was certainly busy between the two jobs. Reportedly, Amy and Steve valued more informal or casual lives. They were not interested in the rat race or climbing any sort of corporate ladder, and Amy was on her way to becoming a personal trainer before she vanished. Amy competed in her first marathon, a 26.2-mile run, in 3 hours and 1 minute, which is an exceptional time, especially for a first marathon.
Wow, that's really... really good for a first marathon. That's, I think that's a sub 7 minute mile. I think it's around 6:55 a mile, which is really fast. My first one, I was proud of. It was 3 hours, 20 minutes, which I think equated to 7.5 minutes a mile. So hers is that's pretty exceptional for a first one.
Yeah, I thought so too. And especially because it was especially impressive because Amy really worked to become a skilled runner. It wasn't just something that, I don't know that anyone's naturally skilled marathon runner. That's definitely something you have to train for and prepare for. But running was more than just something Amy did to stay in shape, you know, or just casually running. It was something important to her. She really enjoyed it. So she used that marathon, her first marathon, to qualify for the Boston Marathon, which she completed in 3 hours and 8 minutes. Amy even aspired to qualify for the 2000 Summer Olympics as a long distance runner, but she never got the chance. Just days before Amy disappeared, she and Steve purchased their first home, a $90,000 ranch-style home near the center of Lander. Amy was ecstatic about this, and it was an exciting time for the couple becoming first-time homeowners. On Thursday, July 24th, 1997, Amy originally planned to drive to her parents' home in Powell to get furniture from them for her new home with Steve. But she told her mom that she had too many things to get done that day, so she wouldn't be coming anymore. Amy and Steve shared breakfast, and then Amy had a list of errands to complete after teaching a youth class at the fitness center. The fitness center's owner recalled it being a typical morning. Amy was in a good mood. It was just a normal day. And although she was in a good mood, he could tell she had a lot to get done. She was eager to kind of wrap up the class and get on with the rest of her day. Steve met his friend Sam 70 miles or 112 kilometers away from Lander in Du Bois to do some mountain climbing. This location is nearly in the middle of Lander and Jackson, and Sam lived in Jackson. So this spot made sense for them to meet, and they've been wanting to check out this spot for a while. Steve and Sam had plenty of experience climbing together, and they'd recently traveled to Australia with Amy for a climbing trip. Steve and Sam were not getting along on that trip. Sam would later say that he enjoyed Amy's presence more than Steve's, and it was bad enough that he decided to fly home early. So when they met up in Du Bois, they put aside their differences and planned to climb together as they had done so many times before. In the meantime, Amy ran errands, including getting the utilities set up for their new home, dropping items off at a recycling bin, stopping by Camera Connection, a camera store in Lander, as well as dropping off a few photos to be framed at the portrait studio above Camera Connection. The employee working that day remembered seeing Amy around 2:30 p.m., and they talked a bit about the photos because Amy was submitting them for a photo contest. So this was not a quick in and out interaction. And sources say she was there anywhere between 5 and 15 minutes. The Camera Connection employee said Amy was dressed in clothes that made it appear she was about to go on a run. He was clear that it didn't look like she was coming from a run. She wasn't sweating or anything. The employee also remembered Amy checking her watch several times while they interacted. It's believed that directly from Camera Connection in the portrait studio in Lander, Amy headed to the Shoshone National Forest about 30 minutes outside of town to map out, measure, and prepare for an upcoming uphill 10K race she was organizing. Her gym was planning on sponsoring the race that was to occur a couple of months after she disappeared. This race would involve a steep climb up gravel switchbacks ending near Fry Lake. In this area, I just have to say, it looks so desolate, but as you'll find out, there were a few other people around that day. Steve and Sam had to cut their excursion short because of storms in the area, and Steve returned home between 4 and 5 p.m. When he noticed Amy wasn't home, he wasn't all that concerned. Her car wasn't there, so he figured she was out running errands or on a run. He seemed to be aware that she was planning to map out the 10K race that day. And by aware, I mean he had an idea that she would be doing this, but she did not directly tell him she was. It was typical for Amy to be out for about an hour on a 6 to 7 mile run on any given day. But with each hour that ticked by, he began to grow a little more concerned. There's conflicting information about whether Steve ate dinner with his climbing friend Todd and his wife, or if he ate alone. From what I could find, it's more likely that he ate alone. But either way, Todd and his wife, and I keep saying Todd and his wife because his wife's name is also Amy. I don't want to confuse things here, but Todd and his wife asked Steve if he wanted to join them to see a movie, but Steve declined, explaining that Amy hadn't made it home. Steve began calling Amy's friends and family around 9 p.m., including her parents, who lived nearly 200 miles away in Powell, Wyoming. Amy's mom, Joanne, picked up the phone call, and Steve asked her if she had seen Amy. Joanne told him no, she didn't know where Amy was. Joanne asked if something was wrong, but Steve told her everything was okay. And although they were far away, Amy's parents were, her initial plan was to go to her parents' house that day. She, of course, changed this plan, but it's still reasonable to check with them. When Todd and his wife arrived home from seeing a movie, they stopped by Steve and Amy's home to see if Amy returned. Much to their surprise, Amy had not returned and Steve was panic-stricken. Todd and his wife offered to help Steve by searching for Amy. Their first stop was the area in the Shoshone National Forest where the 10K race that Amy was prepping for would be. In the meantime, Steve hung back at home and contacted the Fremont County Sheriff's Department around 10:30 or 10:45 p.m. to report that Amy was missing. Then around 1 a.m., Steve received a phone call from Todd and his wife, and they indicated that they found Amy's white Toyota Tercel wagon while driving along the loop road that takes you into the Shoshone National Forest. Her car was parked at the Burnt Gulch Turnout in the Wind River Mountains, situated above Lander. This was the area where Amy's 10K race would be.
Did they notice anything weird about the car or anything that seemed off?
Kind of. So Amy's car was unlocked and they found her sunglasses, to-do list for the day, and her car keys on the passenger seat. And it's often reported that Amy's list was completely checked off except for run, but Investigation Discoveries Disappeared covered this case years ago and they had a picture of the list. So you can see she had Run and Lyft on the list. Some of the other tasks were checked off, like set up utilities and drop off recycling, but others such as mow lawn or get more boxes were not checked off either. The way Amy's car was left made it appear as though Amy did exactly what she planned to do. She drove to the area to run. Then further supporting this, at the bottom of Amy's list, she had written out milepost descriptions of landmarks along the route of the race. She was using the odometer in her car to identify each mile so that she could make sure the length of the race she had in mind was in fact 6.2 miles. And do they mark miles for races?
Yeah, for a 10K, they usually mark every single mile. Like in a marathon, they usually go every 3 or 4 miles.
Okay. So since she was organizing this, she would need to go back and put markers before the race.
Yeah. Usually it's just a sign that says the mile number.
Okay. Yeah. So I think that's why she was writing it down, so that one, like I just said, she could measure the race, make sure it's the appropriate length, but two, she could go back to those spots closer to the time of the race and put markers there. It was mostly uphill until the last mile or so of the race that would lead runners to Fry Lake, where they could dip in to cool off if they wanted. Notably, Amy's fanny pack and wallet were missing, which she typically left in her car. And the keys were in the car too. Like I said, I don't think it's all that strange that she left her keys in her car. This was something Amy normally did because when you're running, you don't want to have to carry anything. And she presumably felt that her car would be safe there. What is strange though is that she would take her fanny pack and wallet, but then leave the keys behind. I just thought you might as well take your keys and tuck them in the fanny pack.
Yeah, I agree that that is strange. It doesn't, I mean, you can pull the main key off and just put it in the fanny pack. It's not going to add much weight or anything. Yeah, that is just a little strange that the keys were left in the car.
The only thing I could think of is maybe the keys would jangle around in the fanny pack.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I do the same thing where I guess not the same thing, but I pull off my main key so it's not jingling around with anything else.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, it's just weird because if she normally left all that stuff in the car, why did she decide to not this time? But it could be a red herring. So the initial concern was that Amy was hurt. Maybe she sustained some sort of injury that rendered her immobile and she needed medical attention. Maybe an animal attacked her. This was the line of thinking for both her family and law enforcement. Something I should bring up, it's not widely reported in this case, but I did see it mentioned a couple of times. So I'm not sure the veracity of it, but I saw it a couple of times that Amy had shin splints at the time, or she was recovering from having shin splints. It was described as a minor case of shin splints.
Yeah, I've only had shin splints one time when I was training for a race, and they're extremely painful. There was a point when I was recovering and it was painful to even walk for a day or two. And when I got them, I looked up, just Googled, can I continue running, training for this? And everything suggested no, stop all running activities because it could lead to stress fractures in your legs. So I'm kind of wondering if she was still training and running while having shin splints, could this have led to some sort of fracture, and you know, it caused her to stop in her tracks and rest on the side of the road or something, and something ensued from there.
That's a good point. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. And I know it's such a minor case of shin splints, but we don't know. I mean, she was at the point where I guess she was feeling comfortable enough to run, but she also could have pushed herself a little too much. Once Steve received the news about Amy's car, he and a friend immediately headed to the location, prepared to search for her. The group of four began searching for Amy, expanding out from her car and yelling her name. About an hour later, deputies with the sheriff's department arrived. They found no sign of struggle or attack near Amy's car or anywhere in that general area. By 3 a.m., a major search was underway. And unfortunately, because the area was not being treated as a crime scene, there was no preservation of Amy's car or the area around it. And to make matters worse, Todd was allowed to drive her car home. The Fremont County Sheriff's Department was assisted by many other agencies in the search, including the U.S. Forest Service, Civil Air Patrol, and local fire departments. They also had search dogs, their handlers, helicopters with heat-seeking sensors, people on all-terrain vehicles alongside Amy's family and friends, plus hundreds of volunteers. It seemed like every resource you could hope for was brought in. Over the next few days, they covered a 30-mile radius in a grid search, but heavy rains hampered the searches within the first week. Investigators felt confident that they had not overlooked Amy within the area they searched, and the search was scaled back as the possibility of foul play became more likely. Other than Amy's car, there were a couple of potential signs of her recovered. Early articles about Amy's disappearance indicated that searchers came upon a distinctive pen about 3/4 of a mile or 1.2 kilometers away from Amy's car, just off the side of the road. And this was believed to be a pen Amy kept on a clip in her wallet. It's interesting because in what scenario is Amy's pen being separated from her wallet that is presumably contained in her fanny pack? And that spot is interesting too. Did something happen 3/4 of a mile away from Amy's car? But the idea that this pen was Amy's was never conclusive. And that was for a couple of reasons. According to the Frozen Truth podcast, Steve said it was the right pen, but it was the wrong color. Amy's pen was apparently green, and this was a blue pen. Although we know Amy had to have a pen with her to mark off her to-dos, and there was no pen found inside her car. So was Steve misremembering, or did Amy have the same type of pen in a different color? I should also note that a searcher who was interviewed for the Frozen Truth podcast shared that the pen was found a mile or two from Amy's car rather than what initial articles said about it being 3/4 of a mile away. He also said that Amy's fingerprints were not on the pen, but I'm not entirely convinced that this was not Amy's pen. It seems like too strange of a coincidence since it is described as a distinctive pen and Amy's pen was not in her car. Strangely, search dogs cannot track Amy's scent beyond about a 5-foot or 1.5 meter radius around the car. Early reports indicate that shoe prints that match the shoes Amy wore were found tracked up over a ridge to where it appeared she then turned around and headed back in the direction of her car. The route crossed one stream, but it wouldn't have been a danger to cross this stream. But then a few days after those details came out, the lead investigator with the Fremont County Sheriff's Department said that these shoe prints belonged to a camper in the area who just happened to have the same or similar shoes as Amy. And other sources say the shoe prints were trampled over by searchers, which seems highly likely, or that rain washed them away. And we do know it rained the day or the afternoon Amy disappeared, so that seems viable too. To my knowledge, they never found shoe prints that could be confirmed as Amy's. About 5 days after Amy disappeared, the Sheriff's Department reclassified Amy's case. It went from a missing person investigation to a criminal investigation. The main reason was that they hadn't found Amy through their searches, and FBI agents from different offices were brought in to assist. Early on, Amy's family put up a $10,000 reward, which was later increased to $100,000 through donations. And this reward was for anyone with information leading to her whereabouts. Steve started the Amy Rowe Bechtel Recovery Fund to raise money for expenses related to searching for Amy. As the news of Amy's disappearance began to spread, individuals came forward to share that they believed they saw Amy the day she disappeared. A couple stated that on the afternoon Amy disappeared, they were driving on Loop Road, which is likely where she would have been running, and they saw a young woman who was running who matched Amy's description. They even joked that she was running so fast that someone must have been chasing her. Amy was a fast runner, and they didn't see others running, so it's very possible that this was Amy, and they said it was unusual for them to see someone running way up there anyway, so it stuck out to them.
Was this along the path of the 10K she was mapping out?
It was on the same road, but I don't know exactly where they saw her. I think Amy was more measuring out the race, you know, using the odometer on her car, checking out the course, and then parked her car and then started running. But it's really hard to say because the last confirmed sighting of her was at the camera store. One other note about this couple, they also saw Amy's vehicle, and the woman remembered seeing something red in the back of her car, but we don't know what she saw. There was nothing red in the back of Amy's car when it was found, nor was Amy wearing red as far as anyone knows. So that might have been nothing. And there were a couple of other potential sightings of her from that day from other witnesses. One who remembered her wearing a fanny pack, which I thought was helpful. Another was a surveyor working in the area who potentially saw Amy running uphill that afternoon while he was working. And a storm rolled in and he thought he would offer the runner a ride if he passed her. But as he descended the hill driving on Loop Road, according to Runner's World, he didn't see the runner, but he recalled having to maneuver around a blue-green vehicle, not Amy's vehicle, which may have been a van that was stopped in the road. If his memory was accurate and there was a blue-green vehicle stopped in the road, that person did not come forward. On August 2nd, 9 days after Amy was last seen, a hiker contacted the sheriff's department to say that on the day of Amy's disappearance, she saw a light blue pickup truck speed past her near Loop Road, driven by a man with a blonde woman inside, and Amy is described as having blonde hair. Now, Steve drove a light blue pickup truck. Some of the reporting on this detail is bizarre. People magazine wrote in March 1998, quote, "On August 2nd, a woman whose identity has not been made public called police to say that at around 5 p.m. on July 24th, she saw Bechtel's," meaning Steve Bechtel's, "light blue pickup truck speeding through a campground near Loop Road with a blonde woman inside," end quote. In my opinion, it's not fair to say that this witness identified the truck as Steve Bechtel's. She saw a truck that matched the description of his, but this witness did not know Amy or Steve, so she did not identify it as Steve's truck. And the kind of area we're talking about here, I would think pickup trucks are a dime a dozen. I think if this were a more unique vehicle, it would hold a little more significance. Phone records from Steve and Amy's landline confirmed that Steve was home at 4:43 p.m., which aligned with when he said he arrived home. So there was a phone call. He called someone from his home at that time. So how could he have been seen at 5 p.m. when he made a phone call from home at 4:43 p.m.? It's not impossible, but he would have to have driven pretty quickly since the locations were 30 or so minutes apart. Plus, I think for this to be accurate, the witness would have to be off in her timing. I think she would have had to have seen the truck and the people inside it after 5 p.m. The witness was unable to identify Steve as the driver, but when she saw his truck, she thought that was the same kind of truck she saw that day. But from there, Steve became a major focus in this investigation, And it was this detail, along with several other pieces of information, that made them so interested in Steve and Amy's disappearance, which we'll get into. But before we do, I want to discuss Steve's alibi for the day a little bit more. Investigators got in touch with Sam, who could corroborate Steve's alibi about going to Du Bois to rock climb the day of Amy's disappearance. Sam confirmed that he indeed did meet Steve to go rock climbing that day. Law enforcement was interested in finding more concrete evidence that they were where they said they were that day. They were unable to find any witnesses who saw Steve and Sam rock climbing that day, but there was a purchase for gas in Du Bois on Sam's credit card that day. And investigators kind of brushed that off as if it doesn't prove anything. And sure, it doesn't prove that Steve was there, but keep in mind that Sam lived about an hour and a half away from Du Bois. So I think this is significant because it indicates that Sam, or if we're getting technical, his credit card was in that area. Steve told investigators that he and Sam stopped at a store in Du Bois where Sam purchased a hammer. And reportedly, there was a receipt produced for this that showed Sam paid in cash. It's phrased as though there was some sort of record of this, but I don't know what other kind of record you would have other than a receipt. The owner did not recall seeing them. Shortly after Amy disappeared, Sam headed to Thailand, where he had a second home, and investigators said he hadn't yet returned to discuss apparent discrepancies in the timeline of the day. Sam later came out, basically said, "Hey, I got along better with Amy than Steve on the recent trip to Australia." He said he would not cover for someone who might have murdered his friend. Investigators felt that even if Steve went rock climbing that day, as he said he did, he still had a couple of hours, mainly between 3 and 5 p.m., where he could have harmed Amy. But even without this gap in time, the investigation would have turned to Steve because he's Amy's husband. And if Amy fell victim to violence, her husband is a likely suspect. Investigators listened back to Steve's 911 call where he reported Amy missing. Steve said, quote, "Hi, this is Steve Bechtel calling. I'm missing a person and I was wondering if you maybe had an extra," end quote.
What?
I know. Yeah, it's certainly not how people typically reported their spouse missing. And the investigators were puzzled by this.
I'm puzzled by that.
Yeah, in my opinion, it's a little off-putting just considering the situation. And I've seen people try to dissect this online, but it's just two sentences. There's not much there. But personally, yeah, when I'm in a situation where I'm worried about something, but I'm also worried that I might be overreacting, I totally try to downplay it. And that could be what was happening.
Yeah. I see why people have tried to dissect that online. I mean, right off the bat, he describes his wife as a missing a person.
But it's also not what you would say if you were trying to pretend you were concerned. At least that's my viewpoint here. If you actually were responsible for something that happened to your wife and you wanted to report her as missing and come across as genuinely concerned, like you didn't know, that's most likely not what you would say. So I think without knowing Steve personally and his kind of the way he talks, it's hard to make sense of this call. And 911 dispatchers have weighed in on this too, saying that it's not uncommon. Like, this might seem weird, but it's not uncommon for people to inject some levity in a serious situation like this. Despite what investigators thought about Steve's 911 call, it was not evidence of guilt. And last thing I'll say is that they've never released the entire 911 call, so who knows what else he said. That might have been, he might have led with this odd intro and then it could have seemed normal from there. Or who knows, maybe he has said other weird stuff. But something I learned about Steve through my research was that he does not care what people think about him. So it didn't seem to affect him much that this snippet of the 911 call was released and people had opinions about it. Amy's family shared with law enforcement that Amy and Steve's relationship was not all rainbows and butterflies. They shared on Disappeared that they felt Steve controlled much of the relationship. He called the shots. Amy's mom, Joanne, described it as Amy was compliant while Steve was in control. which her family said was uncharacteristic of the Amy they knew. It was not her personality type to be submissive. Amy's brother and his wife, who was the director of a shelter for women who were victims of domestic violence, recalled one incident where they visited Amy and Steve. They noticed that Amy had some bruises on her arm. They asked where the bruises came from, and Amy's brother stated that Steve then stood up and started massaging Amy's shoulders. Amy brushed it off and said, "Oh, Steve gets a little rough sometimes." After Amy's brother and wife left, they discussed how odd the situation was. It sounded like Amy's response was in jest, but if my sister said that, I would be like, okay, but where did those actually come from? And if she was evasive at that moment, and I was actually concerned, I would probe further one-on-one. And there were several times where Amy's brother tried to express his concern to Amy about her relationship, but Amy consistently evaded a response. Steve denied ever laying a hand on Amy. The investigators confronted Steve early on, and an FBI agent who was included in the interview directly told Steve that he had reason to believe that Steve was involved in Amy's disappearance and presumed murder. Steve was shaken and surprised by this, and they told him a polygraph could clear things up. Reportedly, he initially agreed to take the polygraph, but then he left the interview and got an attorney who advised him not to take the polygraph. And his attorney said they instruct all of their clients not to take polygraphs due to their unreliability and inadmissibility. Steve said, quote, "Whether I take that test or not should have no bearing on the ability to find Amy. If the law enforcement people are so incapable that they can't find a woman without figuring out whether or not I sweat when I talk, I think we're dealing with a really pathetic organization," end quote. The investigators were disappointed in this, and they continued to attempt to get Steve to take a polygraph exam despite his refusal. I think Steve did the right thing getting an attorney so early on. If something happened to you, Sean, and I'd obviously be innocent in that scenario, an investigator came to me and they said they had reason to believe I was involved, I would be terrified that they would try to pin it on me, and I would absolutely get an attorney if I didn't already have one.
Yeah, I feel like you have to, regardless of innocence.
If you don't, you're at risk of being wrongfully accused. I'm not sure what information law enforcement presented to do it, but they were granted search warrants for Steve's truck and the home he shared with Amy. They sent off physical evidence, or what they thought might be physical evidence, to the state crime lab in Cheyenne, but the results showed nothing of significance. Cadaver dogs and luminol tests were fruitless as well. They didn't find much of note. They certainly didn't find evidence that a crime occurred in either his car or their home, but they came upon these journals or writings of Steve's that were alarming to them. Amy's family saw the journals and described them as incredibly detailed. Amy's brother said these were Steve's deepest thoughts about a variety of topics, including how he viewed women, things he liked to do that were violent, as well as writings of controlling behavior related to his relationship with Amy. Amy's mom was in complete disbelief about the journals. On the other hand, one of Amy's sisters said the writings didn't lead her to believe Steve had a hand in Amy's disappearance. She told the Casper Star Tribune, quote, "I think any person holds private thoughts. Some people happen to write these private thoughts down on a piece of paper. It doesn't mean they were ever meant for someone else to look at," end quote. Steve's friend, Todd, was presented with the journals as well. And the way law enforcement presented it to him was, "Hey, Todd, we're going to present a whole different side of Steve that you've never seen before." And when Todd read the journals, he was completely unfazed by the contents. So it's interesting to have these dueling perspectives. You have some people who don't seem that alarmed by the writings, and then you have Amy's mom and brother who seemed, and law enforcement, who seemed to think they were pretty concerning. When Steve was questioned about the writings, he said they were mostly fictional. In an interview with the Today Show, he said the writings were song lyrics from his band in high school and poems and stories he wrote. He described it as a trashy way to get rid of feelings. Steve's journals have not been shared publicly, so we don't know the specific contents, but based on what some of Amy's family described, I can see why they were concerned about these writings. Although, as I just said, others said the writings weren't all that bad. And there was tension between Steve and Amy's family. They felt that for the investigation to progress, Steve needed to cooperate with law enforcement and submit to a polygraph. However, one of Amy's sisters, the one who wasn't as disturbed by his writings, said that she believed Steve taking a polygraph would be unproductive. While the entire family was united in their hope for Amy's safe return, there were differing opinions regarding Steve and Steve taking a polygraph.
Yeah, it is concerning that some of the contents in the journals were apparently violent, not fantasies, but just violent thoughts that he was having. But it's hard to say, or it's hard to speak to the significance of the journals without actually reading them firsthand, right?
I agree. I feel like I can't really make an opinion on them without seeing them firsthand. When all of this was going on, the media was reporting on it, and many people close to Steve were bothered by the way he was being portrayed, and they came forward and shared these feelings. And through my research, I came across many letters to the editors of various publications that reported on Amy's case from people who supported Steve. A close friend of Steve's described him as an easygoing guy where what you see is what you get. Two of Steve's ex-girlfriends wrote letters, and I thought it was interesting that they both independently used the word gentle to describe Steve, and they had respect for him. They said Steve was never abusive, controlling, or aggressive, and they seemed to still have friendships with Steve. Steve and Amy's friend Todd and his wife described Amy and Steve's relationship as warm and loving. So while there was this sort of negative picture of Steve out there, it's important to share that there were plenty of people coming to his defense too. 2 months after Amy disappeared, the 10K race she was planning took place along part of the route Amy was scouting. Participants paid $12 to enter the race, and the funds went to the Amy Rowe Bechtel Recovery Fund. 150 people, including Steve and Amy's family, took part in the race, and Amy's family was thrilled to see such a large turnout. During the investigation, the FBI learned from NASA engineers that satellite images were taken on the day of Amy's disappearance by Russia's Mir space station of the Burnt Gulch area where Amy's car was and where she was last known to be. In September 1997, the Billings Gazette described it this way, quote, "With hundreds of satellites snapping hundreds of pictures in various stages of the Earth's rotation, Mir was just in the right place at the right time, aimed at central Wyoming on the afternoon of July 24th, end quote. Investigators figured they wouldn't be able to make out a person from these mirror images, but they believed they would be able to see cars in the area. If images were taken in the area where Amy was running at the time, it could potentially reveal a vehicle of interest. It was a cumbersome and expensive process, and while this seemed like a promising and interesting lead, within a few months, it came out that this was a dead end. Cloud coverage and weather problems made it impossible to get a worthwhile image from that day. And that was just one of many dead ends in Amy's case. There were rumors that someone from the nearby Wind River Reservation was driving drunk in the area. Amy went running, hit her, and then disposed of her body with the help from passengers in the vehicle. Law enforcement worked with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they found this specific vehicle at the origin of the tips. However, they found nothing in the vehicle, and ultimately this appeared to be an unsubstantiated rumor. There were many reported sightings of Amy over the years, but coverage of Amy's disappearance on the Geraldo Rivera show brought Amy's case to a national level, which is exactly what they hoped for. And people called in with sightings of her from various parts of the country. There were people in Texas, Utah, Wisconsin, Mexico, Colorado, and beyond who thought they saw Amy, but none of these panned out. There was one sighting in Florida that seemed particularly promising, but the person was determined not to be Amy. Amy's siblings and Fremont County Sheriff and lead investigator Dave King were interviewed on the Geraldo Rivera show. During the interview, King said that if anyone was holding up the investigation, it was Steve, although he stopped short of accusing Steve of anything. Over time, repeated searches were conducted for Amy. The bottom of Fry Lake, where the 10K race was to end, was dragged, as well as other lakes in the area, but no trace of Amy was found. Mine shafts and the sinks of Sink Canyon were also thoroughly searched, all to no avail. The search efforts did not cease after initial attempts. They continued diligently, but not as frequently, yet consistently yielded no signs of her. In February 1998, about 7 months after Amy disappeared, Steve and several of his climbing friends attempted to climb the northeast side of Mount Hooker, about 26 miles west of Lander. Apparently, this face of Mount Hooker had not been climbed before in the winter. Shortly after making the trek out to where they would climb, Steve became ill. It was believed that he was experiencing intense altitude sickness, but it was so bad that a helicopter with the Wyoming Medical Center in Casper had to fly Steve out of the area to their hospital where he was treated. Steve made it out okay after receiving treatment, and the incident didn't deter him from continuing to climb.
So at this point, do the investigators believe Steve had something to do with her disappearance?
Yes, they were still very much focused on Steve, but they were always asking the public for tips or leads from them. And they even went on Unsolved Mysteries in April 1999. So this is now about 3 years after Amy was last seen. There wasn't a lot of movement in the case. And Amy's family and Steve hoped that coverage on that scale would lead to new developments. And law enforcement hoped for that too. Steve, along with Amy's siblings, participated in the Unsolved Mysteries coverage. And a lot of tips came in after the program aired, mostly from people outside of Wyoming, which investigators believed was because most people in Wyoming were familiar with the case already. But all of the leads investigated turned out to be false leads. In 2000, the Fremont County Sheriff and lead investigator in Amy's case, Dave King, who was quite open about his suspicions of Steve, abruptly resigned. Shortly thereafter, the state of Wyoming charged Dave with 3 drug-related crimes. Dave stole drugs, namely cocaine, from an evidence locker at the Fremont County Sheriff's Office. He had to be hospitalized after using so much of the cocaine. It sounded like Dave had a substance abuse issue, but I would be very uncomfortable if the person investigating my family member's disappearance was taking part in something like that. That there are ethical concerns there. In June 2003, nearly 6 years after Amy disappeared, a man hunting for elk in the area of Amy's car came upon a Timex Iron Man watch alongside some bones. Amy wore a Timex Iron Man watch. He did not retrieve the watch, but when he arrived home and told others about what he found, they suggested he tell the authorities. By the time he did, snowfall made it impossible to search for the watch and bones, but when the weather cleared enough to search these items, investigators found the watch and bones. The bones were determined to be elk bones, and the watch was missing its band and no longer working. Unfortunately, they were never able to confirm if the watch belonged to Amy. The watch was a common, inexpensive model, making identification more difficult. If it was indeed Amy's, it was in that general area of her car, but it traveled quite a distance from there. And apart from a pen believed to be hers, it was the only trace of her found.
I don't see how that would be anyone else's. Like, who else is going to lose a watch in the same vicinity as Amy?
Where the watch was found was not where she would have been running, but it was in the same general area. So how it would have gotten over there, I'm not sure. But yes, I see your point that it does seem strange that someone who had the same watch as Amy would also happen to lose their watch in the same general vicinity. That does seem weird. 9 years before Amy disappeared, in March 1988, 18-year-old Lisa Marie Kimmel disappeared while driving through Wyoming. She was found murdered about a week later in a Wyoming river, but her case remained a mystery for about 14 years until DNA evidence linked a man named Dale Wayne Eaton to the brutal murder. Some of you might know this as the Little Miss murder. Eaton, who was in his late 50s when he was caught, is described as a drifter, loner, and divorced father. Lisa's car was buried on his property in Moneta, Wyoming. And we have talked about a lot of cases here. I'm familiar with a lot of true crime cases, and I've never heard of someone burying an entire car. That just seems like it would take such effort to do that when there are other ways you could probably destroy that car. He was charged and convicted of the kidnap, rape, and murder of Lisa. The FBI was involved in the case, and they felt strongly that Eaton had committed other crimes because, as they put it, sexually sadistic killers rarely act once. His personality and the way he killed Lisa were consistent with that of serial killers. Eaton was looked into in various unsolved homicides and disappearances, including Amy's case. Eaton refused to ever speak of Amy or other cases, but investigators established that Eaton was likely in the Lander area when Amy disappeared. When Eaton killed Lisa, he lived in Moneta, and that is only about an hour's drive away from Lander, but he either moved to the Lander area and lived there when Amy disappeared, or he was visiting. Early on in the investigation into Amy's disappearance, Eaton's own brother came forward to law enforcement to say that Eaton would camp in the Burnt Gulch area, which is where Amy's car is parked. So this was before it was known that Eaton killed Lisa Marie Kimmel. And his brother believed Eaton was there when Amy disappeared. And this was not that popular of an area to camp, and not many people outside of Lander knew about it. Investigators looked into the tip, but seemed to rule it out at the time based on statements from Eaton's niece. She said he was not in the Lander area at that time, although from what I could find, they later established he likely was in the Lander area. Eaton also killed his cellmate in a fit of rage when he was held after being charged with the attempted kidnapping of a family. And it was that attempted kidnapping and the later arrests that entered his DNA into CODIS to later be connected with Lisa. Interestingly, according to the Frozen Truth podcast, the witness who saw that van after he saw a woman running on the day of Amy's disappearance I told you about earlier, well, that van reportedly matched the description of a van Eaton owned. To date, the possibility that Dale Wayne Eaton harmed Amy remains, but there's no evidence to link him to her disappearance. Some have suspected that Eaton was the Great Basin murderer responsible for the murders of women across the states of Utah, Nevada, Idaho, and Wyoming from the early 80s to 1997 when Amy disappeared. It's likely that more than one person is behind these murders, but the serial killer theory persists, and Eaton seems like a good suspect. And we're not going into depth on Eaton and his background because I don't want to get too off track from Amy's case, but there's plenty of information about him out there if you want to do a deep dive.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that that led nowhere. It seemed like a massive lead and that Eaton may have had something to do with this, but yeah, just unfortunate that it led to nowhere. Do you know how long they focused on him before they decided he likely didn't have anything to do with it?
It wasn't very long, and I don't think it helped that they were so focused on Steve. Plus, they have this concern that because there was a cash reward for information out there, that maybe Eaton's brother was trying to get that cash reward. But to say that about your own brother, I mean, they probably didn't have a good relationship if he was saying this, right? But the reward was not for people who gave information like that. It was for people who could lead investigators to the whereabouts of Amy. So this notion that he was just coming forward to try to get the reward money doesn't make a lot of sense. 7 years after Amy disappeared, Steve went through the process of having her declared legally dead. Amy's mom was upset by this because she felt until they have evidence that Amy is dead, then Amy isn't dead. Steve also remarried that year, and he and his new wife went on to have two children. And from what I could find, Steve still lives in Lander and he is still very much involved in the rock climbing community. He's even written a book about training to rock climb. In 2011, a new investigator took on Amy's case. And at that time, Steve decided to finally be re-interviewed. And the new investigator felt that the people investigating Amy's disappearance originally got tunnel vision and focused too much on Steve. And he seems to think that Eaton is a much better suspect in Amy's disappearance. Throughout my research, I kept finding this idea brought up ad nauseum, saying if Steve would just take the polygraph, we could rule him out. Take the polygraph and pass, I should say. They could rule him out. And it makes no sense because you can be guilty and still pass a polygraph. And you can be innocent and not pass a polygraph. I just think there was way too much of an emphasis on the polygraph portion of the investigation. And let's get into the theory that Steve was responsible for Amy's disappearance. Investigators asserted that they had no proof that Amy was the one to drive where her car was parked. But I think there is an argument to be made that she did. The to-do list in her car had the landmark descriptions of each mile in the race. So she was measuring the race, and they believe this was done with the odometer in her car. Plus, there were several independent witnesses who believed they saw Amy running in the area that day. And considering runners were not common in that area at that time, the sightings feel significant. But investigators attempted to push this idea that maybe Amy didn't drive her car there, and if someone else did, it may have been Steve. It seemed from the beginning that they felt Steve was responsible, and they tried to make the evidence fit their chosen story. And we don't harp on poor police investigations on our podcast because I tend to stay away from cases with terrible investigations because they're so frustrating. But also we don't have personal experience in law enforcement. So we try not to be hypercritical, but I can relate this generally to my career as a data analyst. You have to let the data tell the story, and it should be the same way in an investigation such as this one. If I were to pick a story I wanted to tell, and then craft the data to tell that story, that would be highly unethical and irresponsible, right? To pick certain data points and include those, but then leave others out so that I could build this story. So it appeared as though law enforcement picked Steve as their guy and then focused on him, but there is no actual evidence that points to Steve being responsible for harming Amy. There would have been a tight timeline in which he would have harmed her, a timeline that doesn't make a lot of sense. And many have wondered why he would hunt her down while she's running. If he were to harm her, it would make more sense to do it at home.
I disagree with that. She's going out to this rural area where there wouldn't be hardly any witnesses at all. I feel like that would be a better place than doing it at home.
There wouldn't have been or shouldn't have been witnesses at home either. But I see what you're saying. If her last known location or the last sighting of her is at home with Steve, and that's what it would be in that scenario, that is more suspicious than if it's some other location.
But that, if he did follow her, that would be premeditated, right? If it did happen at home, that would be likely be in the heat of the moment.
Yes. And when we talk about premeditation, then there would have to be a known motive. And with Steve, they couldn't really find a motive for him to harm Amy. I mean, she had a really small life insurance policy of a few thousand dollars, but he was worse off financially without Amy. Without Amy's income, Steve could no longer afford to move into the house they just purchased a few days before she disappeared. So he ended up staying in their rental home. There is conflicting information about Amy's student loans. Some reports stated that she recently paid them off before she vanished, which would be quite impressive for someone who had just graduated a couple of years prior, while other reports indicate that Steve was on the hook for about $30,000 in her student loan debt after she disappeared. So I'm not sure which is true. Quite a big difference there. Point being, there was no monetary gain for Steve with Amy out of his life. He also didn't hop into a new relationship after she disappeared. So I think if Steve did harm Amy, the motive would have been most likely that he didn't want her in his life anymore for some reason, or it was a heat of the moment situation and there's just a completely different story here that we're not aware of.
And he also apparently had some pretty violent thoughts that he wrote down in his journals. However, you know, some people were on his side and said that those journal entries weren't concerning.
And yeah, I think that's the thing about Steve is that there's really no evidence that he harmed Amy, but sometimes he says things that are unsettling. Like I wrote down one quote he said in an interview with Runner's World. He said, "You could take the strongest woman, a Division I athlete, and the average guy is going to be able to overpower her. And a man will be able to sprint faster, and he's going to have this capability of overpowering this woman. There's a fantasy of knowing self-defense move, or that an athletic woman, a runner especially, is going to be able to outrun a guy. In practice, that doesn't occur, I don't think." I personally don't think Steve harmed Amy. I think it was most likely a crime of opportunity, but it's statements like this that just rub you the wrong way a little bit. And it's not that I don't understand that men are generally stronger than women. Biologically, it makes sense, but it's the specific comments about basically he's saying no matter how fast women are, a man's always going to be able to run faster than you. At least that's how I took it. And I just find that statement weird when Amy was such a fast runner. I think she could outrun a lot of people. So the statement just, like I said, rubs you the wrong way.
Yeah. What an odd thing to say. Why put that out there?
And then saying fantasies of learning self-defense so you think you can protect yourself. Like, why would you describe that as a fantasy? But Steve is not the only person at the center of a theory in this case. There's Dale Wayne Eaton, right? How does he fit into this? It's certainly interesting when you have someone known to be capable of murder and other heinous crimes, likely in the area when a woman disappears, never to be seen again. If Dale Wayne Eaton was in, if he saw Amy that day running, point I'm trying to make here is that we know based on his background that he would be capable of likely kidnapping her and harming her. The investigator who took on Amy's case in 2011 dove into Eaton's past and tried to speak with him, but Eaton refused. And this refusal makes it unlikely that we will ever know if he's connected to Amy's disappearance unless she's found one day or someone else has information. But beyond Eaton, there could have been another predator out that day. Who it could be, I have no idea. But someone could have taken advantage of a young woman running alone in an area without many other people. I go back to that witness, the surveyor who thought he saw Amy, but when he was leaving the area, he didn't see her when I think he expected her to still be there, and he saw a vehicle stopped in the road. If true, who was driving that vehicle and why didn't they come forward? Another theory involving foul play came up earlier when we discussed the rumors of a drunk driver hitting Amy and disposing of her body. This was not substantiated, but it's not that hard to imagine considering people didn't typically run where Amy was running. So if someone wasn't paying attention or if they were driving under the influence, they could have hit her.
I do want to go back to what we were talking about earlier with her shin splints. Even though it was reported that it was a minor case, I still think she could have re-aggravated it or even sustained an additional injury due to continuing to run on the shin splints. She could have stopped on the side of the road and sat down and gotten hit by a car potentially, and someone hauled her body away and you know, disposed of it. Or someone could have seen her on the side of the road sitting down and asked her if she needed a ride, and something bad ensued from there. I don't think we should dismiss her continuing to run with a minor injury.
Yeah, and that's a good point that someone could have offered her a ride. Even beyond the shin splints, like you said, she could have had some other sort of injury, could have twisted her ankle. Maybe she got to the point where she realized she would have to walk back to her car and it would have been really uncomfortable. Someone could have seen her hobbling along the side of the road, offered her a ride. And with the rain that came in that afternoon, she could have been desperate enough to get back to her car that she accepted the ride. So I definitely think that's a theory here. And beyond Amy being or suffering from an injury, I have seen the idea that Amy got lost. I think that's one of the least likely theories here. I think she would have been found through the searches unless she somehow fell into a spot that made her impossible to find. Amy was prepping for a road race and looking at the Loop Road using Google Street View just in a few spots, it's hard to see how Amy could have gotten lost. The terrain varies, but there are points without many trees on either side of the road. And when you're on a road, it's much harder to get lost than if you were running deep into the forest. I know you've done a trail marathon before and you actually did get kind of turned around, right? During that.
Yeah. Yeah, I got lost. I got lost like 3 times.
So that does not seem that far-fetched if she did venture more into the wilderness. But from my understanding, when she, or who we believe was Amy, she was seen, it was on a road. And looking at this road, it was just one road she was seen on. It's kind of hard to understand how you could get lost.
Yeah, I don't think that's plausible.
I agree. I think for this theory to be correct, the search efforts had to be lackluster or she ended up in some obscure area. And finally, some have proposed the idea of an animal attack. Could a mountain lion or bear have attacked Amy? People far more knowledgeable in this area than me have weighed in saying that, one, there were no cat or bear sightings in the area at that time. Two, there should have been evidence of this, blood, shreds of clothes, drag marks, and three, Amy likely would have been found. On top of that, as we discussed in episode 2, the disappearance of Barbara Bullock, it is rare for mountain lions to attack humans. And according to the National Park Service, the chances of being injured by a bear are approximately 1 in 2.1 million. Combining all of that information makes this theory highly unlikely as well. Right now, it seems that the investigation into Amy's disappearance is completely stalled. Amy's parents put together a resource guide for families of the missing called the Resource Guide for Families of Missing Persons in Wyoming. They hoped few people would need to use it, but they put something together that they would have liked to have when Amy went missing because they didn't know what to do. The guide included what to do and expect, a list of resources, and then suggestions about how to use those resources. Amy's mom has said that there's no way to understand what it's like to have a family member go missing until you experience it yourself. And it's definitely not something you prepare for. So this guide intended to remove some of the burden of having to figure out what to do and who to ask for assistance. They wanted to make something out of a horrible event. And they also set up a few different scholarships in Amy's memory. Amy's dad passed away in 2001 without knowing what happened to her. And Amy's mom has said she has learned to live without Amy, but she has yet to accept it. If you have information related to the disappearance of Amy Robechtel, please contact the Fremont County Sheriff's Office at 307-332-5611. That is all for this week. We will not have a new regular episode next week, but definitely keep an eye out for the collaborative episode we did. Thank you all for listening and supporting the show. Bye.
Bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.